Now let us read in God's most holy word in the Old Testament in the Psalter, the book of Psalms, and we read another of these psalms or songs of ascent. Psalm 123. Now the earlier psalms in this series spoke about the advance of the pilgrims from faraway lands until they reached Jerusalem and the temple. But some of the others speak of some of the thoughts of these pilgrim Jews as they make their way to Jerusalem. And this short psalm does that. The psalmist says, I lift up my eyes to you whose throne is in heaven. As the eyes of slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a servant maid looks to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows his mercy. It doesn't say hands there, notice. So our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows us his mercy. Have mercy on us, O Lord. Have mercy on us, for we have endured much contempt. We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant. Amen. May God bless to us his most holy word. Psalm number 123. Some of these songs of ascent, sung by pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem for the feasts, reflect Israel's experiences, most of them infinitely sad, of course, because like Christians after them, they are a misunderstood people. Many of their troubles, nonetheless, were of their own making, as some of ours may be, too. Is that not so? The complaint in this short psalm is in the last two verses. Have mercy on us, O Lord, have mercy on us, for we have endured much contempt. We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant. But the first verse expressed hope, didn't it? I lift my eyes to you whose throne is in the heavens. And that is emphasized in the book of Lamentations. Let me read to you a little from Lamentations 3:26. Lamentations 3:26, where it says, it is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man to bear the yoke while he is young. Let him sit alone in silence, for the Lord has laid it on him. Isn't that a word? Is that a word to somebody? Let him sit alone in silence, for the Lord has laid it on him. Let him bury his face in the dust. There may yet be hope. let him offer his cheek to one who would strike him, and let him be filled. Remember how Handel's Messiah and tenor solo there. And let him be filled with disgrace. For men are not cast off by the Lord forever. Though he brings grief, he will show compassion. So great is his unfailing love. For he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men. But then, of course, there is judgment for such contempt, isn't there? Oh, yes. What does Jesus say in Matthew 5 and the Sermon on the Mount, 5 and 22? But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raka, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell, he says. But such contempt, nonetheless, is one of the hardest things in the world to bear, isn't it? For often, the very reverse of the old saying is true, that sticks and stones may break my bones, but nicknames won't hurt me. People are sometimes awarded thousands of pounds in damages for hurtful things that have been said or written about them. For they can wound far more deeply than blows. Words can wound far more deeply than wounds. And you can see how deeply the captives in Babylon felt in the psalm we sang this morning. Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked for us songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while we are in a foreign land? They respond, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. And what Jeremiah says about Babylon's portion for all she did to the Jews. If you were to turn to the second last chapter of Jeremiah 51 and 52, you would read this about the judgment that is coming upon those who have so deeply ill-used the Lord's people. 51 and 52, but days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will punish her idols, and throughout her land the wounded will groan. Even if Babylon reaches the sky and fortifies her lofty stronghold, I will send destroyers against her, declares the Lord. The sound of a cry comes from Babylon, the sound of great destruction from the land of the Babylonians. The Lord will destroy Babylon. He will silence her noisy din. Oh, I'm thinking of Moscow and the Kremlin, and 1960 and 61 and 62 and Khrushchev. Do you remember John Kennedy? Some of you are too young to remember that, but many of us do. The Lord will destroy Babylon. He will silence her noisy din. Waves of enemies will rage like great waters. The roar of their voices will resound. As destroyer will come against Babylon, her warriors will be captured and their bows will be broken. For the Lord is a God of retribution. Don't let the world forget it. The Lord is a God of retribution. He will repay in full. I will make her officials and wise men drunk. Her governors, officers, and warriors as well. They will sleep forever and not awake, declares the King, whose name is the Lord Almighty. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Babylon's thick walls will be leveled and her gates set on fire. The peoples exhaust themselves for nothing. The nation's labor is only fuel for the flames. This is the message Jeremiah gave to the staff officer Zariah, son of Neriah, the son of Messiah, when he went to Babylon with Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the fourth year of his reign. Jeremiah had written a scroll about all the disasters that would come upon Babylon, all that had been recorded concerning Babylon. And he said to Zariah, when you get to Babylon, see that you read all these words aloud. Then say, O Lord, you have said you will destroy this place so that neither man nor animal will live in it. It will be desolate forever, and it is largely today. When you finish reading the scroll, tie a stone to it and throw it into the Euphrates. I wonder if it's still recoverable today. Then say, so will Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster I will bring upon her, and her people will fall because of what they did to God's chosen people. And you see, it is in the midst of such sufferings as the Jews have endured that the believing Jew in this psalm of ours looks up. Not to the hills, as at the beginning of Psalm 1:1, but higher than that to the Lord, throne in heaven. Ah, but it is not God's glory that the suffering Jews want to see in their distress. That could be too ironical for them to bear to see his glory when they're suffering so much. They are looking not at the Lord's face, which they could hardly bear to view in their troubles. That's not what they're looking at, his face. It is something far more practical than looks that they need. They are watching his hand. It is help. It is help they need, not pictures of glory. And so the psalmist expresses his desire in terms that every slave or servant understands. He is watching the hand of his master to see if there is any likelihood of relief or any undoing of his slave condition, or as Hagar would have watched Sarah's hand more than her frowning face to see if there was to be any alleviation of poor Hagar's burdensome lot. So says the psalmist in his distress. He is watching for the hand of God to see if it will move toward him with any relief. And so you see, the believing Jew, as is so evident throughout the Psalter, the believing Jew holds on, even in the darkest night, and absolutely and adamantly refuses to give up hope because of his invincible faith. And of course, all true faith is invincible. It must be, because of its source. All true faith is God's faith.
God's faith in himself. Did you know that? That's why we can be so determined in amidst adversity. Why, although sometimes we feel we're down and out, yet something holds on within us. It's God. It's his faith he's given us as a gift. We were reading that in Romans chapter 3 the other week. Paul began in chapter 3 to discuss the advantages of being a Jew when the Jews have just been pronounced equally sinful with the Gentiles. And the apostle meets the rather sour question, what if some did not have faith? With the promising reply, does their lack of faith nullify God's faith and his faithfulness? No. God has faith in himself, even as Jesus had faith in his Father, and therefore in himself also. And such faith cannot fail, because God cannot fail. It is unfaith that fails. It falters, falls away, gives up hope, and sinks into a slough of despond. That cannot be of God. For from his high throne in heaven, he sees every beginning, like the sun rising after the darkest night. And knowing himself, he has hope, because he has faith in himself, and knows not only what he can do, but of all the things that he can do, what he will do, you see. He therefore will be true to himself, as Paul says, even if everyone else in the world is a liar, God cannot lie. And after all, it is not really we who have taken on God when we think we decide to become Christians, any more than the Jews chose God. It was God who chose them from Abraham onwards. And this is what is called unconditional grace. Man didn't creep up from an original slime, like a tadpole becoming a frog and thence a mammal and a man eventually, to call upon a God he had conceived in his heart who would hear him and give him a life worth living. That's the sad evolutionist's cry. That's not what Genesis 1 says. After all the living creatures were created on the fifth day, the Almighty said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish and the birds and the livestock. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, he repeats. Male and female he created them, explaining, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish and the birds and every living creature. So you see, all initiative is with him. Does not the Bible begin? In the beginning, God. So that you see, with all reverence, we can look up into the face of God and say, well, God, you started everything. And being who you are, you would not have started anything you could not finish. So our trust must be in you. There is no one and nothing else for us to put our trust in but you. Ah, but then adversity comes, and it tends to shake our faith. And then we look, dear Lord, then we look from your face to your hand, and wait and long for events
like poor Micawber, we become interventionists, waiting for something to turn up, and we wonder whether in times of long-endured distress and under the duress of cruel foes, it is right for us to keep watching your hand rather than your face. Oh, but you say, we are creatures of time and space and of daily events, and we live by these events. We are always waiting for something to turn up. Yes, he says, but is it always the best attitude to be waiting for something to turn up? Is there a sense in which it is the only attitude, Lord? Like Israel, the night before they left Egypt, were told how to partake of the Passover lamb. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Yes, yes, but that was after more than 400 years of waiting. What kept Israel during the long centuries of cruel oppression which preceded that event of the Exodus? What was it? That it was possible for such as Amram and Jochebed of the tribe of Levi, that it was possible for that couple to arise, and their son Moses to be so wonderfully preserved by the very Egyptians who had plagued their race so much and so long. But in the fullness of time, we see the miracle of God's preservation and protection for them after more than 400 years. If believing Israelites generation after generation kept looking at the hand of their God for action, expecting every day something to turn up and something to happen, they would have died one generation after another in blank despair, wouldn't they? The only way they could have survived to pass on their faith to the next generation, as Psalm 78 advises, was by putting their trust not on their demand for God's interventionist deeds to act now, for he will not dance to our tune and perform our command. How dare we expect such a thing? No, the only way that they could have survived to pass on their faith to the next generation was to put their trust in him and in his nature and in the fact of his great love for his creation, that he wills good and can will nothing but good. And he only permits evil, however horrid it may be and however long we may suffer it. He only permits evil as far as it assists his good. Evil that he has allowed is his servant, his unwilling servant. The devil is his unwilling servant. He's using him. Does that not help us to be patient in tribulation? You see, it is in that spirit that the psalmist in Psalm 78 opened his great epic psalm. Let me read the first verses of it. O my people, says the psalmist, hear my teaching. Listen to the words of my mouth. It's the Lord speaking, of course. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things, things from of old, what we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power and the wonders he has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, while he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so that the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn could tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commandments. They would not be like their forefathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation whose hearts were not loyal to God, whose spirits were not faithful to him. So you see, it is a question. This is my main thought this morning from this short psalm. It is a question whether it is the Lord's face of the Lord's hand that we are to look to in time of trouble. I suppose if the trouble has gone on a long time, as it certainly did with Israel in Egypt, there must often have been a temptation to look down from that impassive divine face, the face of God, and hope for a movement of his hand. But then, you see, there is longing and longing. Impatient longing can do an awful lot of harm, can't it? Hope deferred makes the heart sick. What did it do to Abraham and Sarah? It led to the birth of the Arab race. But you say, had not Abraham and Sarah enough to try them when the promised son did not appear, when they were far past begetting and bearing children? Well, but our God is not confined to the rules of the nature he has created, as we see. If he made nature, he can suspend its action, or speed it up, or do anything with it he likes. Abraham and Sarah. You see, this is what we were looking at last Sunday evening. Of course, Abraham and Sarah had a lapse, which alas produced Ishmael and the Arabs. But God, in the fullness of time, empowered their faith to believe that Ishmael wasn't the answer to God's promise. They swallowed that and said, "We're wrong about this boy of 13 or 17 or whatever age he was. This is not God's way. God is intent on performing a miracle on us, old as we are." As Romans 4 and 17 says, God made Abraham the father of many nations, and it was in God's sight that he made him so. In God's sight that he made him so. Notice that. This was no hole and corner act, but an act in God's sight that he bestowed on Abraham, a faith which believed that God could not only raise the dead, but create for himself something out of nothing. That is to say, he was able, God was able, not only to produce an Isaac from Abraham's and Sarah's sexually dead bodies, but he was able to produce a universe itself
out of nothing, nothing. That's the God we've to believe in.
Ah, so I think that it is his face more than his hand that we must look to. Of course, there will be times, perhaps after long waiting, that God gives us the divine hunch of faith, that it is almost time for him to act, as God told Simeon to wait, because God's consolation was born and would be coming to the temple. You remember? Yes. God gives sometimes the divine hunch of faith that it is almost time for him to act. And so, because we are intensely practical people, we look down from his face to his hand. And we wait to see its movement. But you see, we nonetheless need the intimation that it is time for him to act before we do that. We need to have a hunch. Now's the time, or the time is coming soon. I don't know if anybody in the world had a hunch of what was going to happen in Soviet Russia in 1989. Do you think so? I wonder. You see, the long psalmist seems to have had it, though, when after saying, "Give me discernment that I may understand your statutes," he cries out, you remember, Psalm 119, verse 126, he said, "It is time for you to act, O Lord, your law is being broken." Well, it's always being broken. But whether that in itself constitutes a legitimate demand for us to say to God, "Come now, act now," or not, is a question, isn't it? We need to be very sure. Our faith needs to be very serene and complete before we say, "Now, Lord, revival now, tomorrow, tonight." But you see, the danger is at watching the hand. We're always waiting for something to turn up and something to happen. And certainly our psalmist makes a very good plea for himself when he says, "We have endured much contempt. We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant." And whether the Lord thought the man had had enough, and it was time for him to act against his adversaries, that's a question. How long, O Lord? How long? Well, it was 400 years and more that Israel dwelt in Egypt. And 70 years the Jews were in Babylon. And 70 years believers suffered the rigors of Soviet Russia. How long will it be before China is liberated and Tibet restored? I ask myself that many times every day. How long? That it must come, we feel sure, because of the nature and the character of our God. He's in heaven. He's watching. Perhaps more to the point, we might ask, how long will it be before the Lord comes down upon us in this country and turns our captivity from sheer materialistic worldliness into repentance and amendment of life, and gives us leaders that will lead us to the throne of grace and bow our hearts before God, as both King George V and King George VI knelt before God in St. Paul's Cathedral and asked God's help? I'm sure our dear Queen wouldn't be averse to that, one of the humblest people, I believe, in the whole land. But how much she is her own mistress in that. We hear her expressing her opinion as saying, not that expensive fountain, that was good, wasn't it? Should we not pray for her more? Some would want her to abdicate in favor of her son, and her son is not afraid to speak about spiritual things, and done so this week, but he's a bit mixed up about the spirits, isn't he? In a way that I doubt if she is. Simple, simple, strong woman that I think she is. Oh, what prayers we need to make for these. Few things depress me as much as the statistics which the Church of Scotland establishment gives of the state of the kirk in the land. That, I think, is hand-watching. And while I am the first to rejoice at the proliferation of godly groups in the kirk in Scotland, however tiny and struggling, all over the country, I prefer to do more face than hand watching. For his face may be a precursing intimation of what his hand is about to do. It's the face and the brain behind it that controls the hand, not the hand that controls the brain and the face. Most of our troubles, as we have owned, are of our own making. It is the church which is largely to blame for the state of the nation. We blame our political leaders. We shouldn't so much. We should blame the church more than they. The trumpet, so far from giving an uncertain sound, has scarcely sounded at all. And I suggest to you that if we are truly repentant and ready to turn back to the Lord and to things godly, such as the ministry of the word and prayer, then we plod on as we gaze ever more intently at his face for the beginnings of a smile, just like the sun about to rise. And then we may lower our eyes to his hand and hope for his action, which is what is needed to renew both kirk and nation. But meantime, the God who is ever at work, silently planning in love for us. Did you ever have a placard of that hanging in your wall? I've seen it in many homes. He is silently planning in love for us. God is doing his own work today. As the earth turned round and went down, so that the sun, as we put it, came up quite silently and nobody heard a thing. God is working not only in the spheres, but he's working in men's hearts. He's working in your hearts, is he not? Would you say not? Would you say not this morning that God is not working in your heart while we speak? He neither slumbers nor sleeps. God is working. I believe it. I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe it. God is working silently,
wonderfully working in us. Please God, through us and our witness,
James came very excitedly to me last night after the prayer meeting and said, James sent in our church office and said, have you seen the new cornerstones? The first stones of the corner leading to that beautiful arch. They're there. There's hope. And that's only a poor parable. We're not taken up with the building as such. That's only a poor parable of another church and another tower rising to the skies to be a witness in Aberdeen, to godless Aberdeen, that God is not dead. He's silently planning in love for his children. And whether anything dramatic happens in our day or not, that's not the point. He's working. Oh, do you believe that? Then, don't be interventionists. Keep watching his face, and the time will come when the face will tell you, watch the hand. And if it doesn't come in the life of some of us, it will surely come in the life of some of you younger people. Surely it will. As God is God. And not only China will change, but many in this land will have prime ministers who will not be afraid to name the name of God and Jesus in public. Bow the knee in the Lord's day before him. Surely it will come. It must come. I believe. Do you? Oh, surely. Let's sing our hymn. 156. 156. Ye servants of the Lord, each in his office wait, observant of his heavenly word, and watchful at his gate. Most appropriate. 156.